Welcome to LOA Today. Walt Thiessen and Life Coach Cindy Chavez here. Today is Wednesday, January the 30th, 2019. It's 4 p.m. in New York, 1 p.m. in Los Angeles, 9 p.m. in London, 8 a.m. in Sydney, Australia. Thank you wherever you are in the world tuning in to yet another episode of LOA Today, your daily dose of happy. And I am really happy because I get my co-host back. Cindy's back for another show here. And it's something I'm going to be treasuring more and more because going forward for a bit, you're just going to be doing the Wednesday afternoon podcast with me, Cindy. So if you hear me exuding more and more about it, you'll know why. That's exactly why. Okay.
Wouldn't it be nice?
Wouldn't it be nice if? Oh, yeah. Well, I'm hoping one of these days you'll be able to come back and do some more shows. But, hey, I'll take once a week. Don't get me wrong. I'm glad to have once a week. That's good. I get a little greedy sometimes, and I think that's okay. So, anyway, people are starting to feed into the live stream of the podcast, so we're going to let them do that while we get ready to talk about Neville Goddard. We are talking about your faith is your fortune. Yeah, that's what it is. How long has it been? Wait. I've forgotten.
I know. That's the book that we're in.
That's the book.
If I recall correctly, we are on chapter 7.
Have we done 6?
We're on chapter 6.
And there's Dee Dee. Hi, Dee Dee.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
I didn't see you sneak in there, but I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. Yeah. Glad to be here.
Good thing.
Now, see, this is the second time that I've went back and looked at the chapter, and I went through 6. I was like, yeah, we've done this one. But apparently we haven't. That's what happens when you read a lot.
Yeah, this is true.
Yeah.
This is true. Well, I know part of it is this chapter has even more I ams than the previous chapter had. I counted. There's actually 21 I ams in here. So this is the blackjack of Neville Goddard here.
Jackpot. Awesome.
Jackpot.
Blackjack. Let's do it. So you counted. Wow.
I counted them, okay. Yeah. It shows you how my afternoon was going, but we won't get into that.
No, we'll stay in the present moment, and the afternoon's going just fine.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
So can we backtrack then and do chapter 6? Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right.
I don't think we're really backtracking. I think I've read some of this stuff so much. You know, my husband and I have this joke about some things that you do over and over, and you do them so often that when you try to remember if you've done that thing today, you know, it's like, did you feed the dog? And you try to remember, but you have like 7,000 memories of feeding the dog. So it's like, it's really easy to pull up a memory and say, yeah, I think I did, right? So
well, at one point you did.
Our little dog is not even with us anymore. We don't even have a dog now, but we still use that when we're trying to remember. It's like, did you feed the dog? You know, because it's like, did we read this chapter? I look at it, and I'm sure I've read it, you know, several times in my life. So I look at it, like, yeah, we read this chapter. It's familiar. So, yes, I've fed the dog at some point.
I'm very glad to hear that. I'm sure the dog was glad to hear that, too. That was good.
Time to break out the Neville decoder rings.
Absolutely.
Because we're going to have a lot of scripture in this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
We should have recognized this from the beginning, because with the book being titled Your Faith is Your Fortune, he's pulling out a lot of verses from the Christian Bible. But Neville has a very unique way of looking at these things, and it's not literal at all. It's very metaphorical. So we'll see what he says.
Before you get started, I have to interrupt you already, because I want to make sure that we don't overlook questions from the audience. Nasha has a question before we even get started with Neville.
Oh, good.
And her question is, I have a question. Why is it that we manifest something wonderful and it backfires? Why is it that
I have several answers for that.
Okay.
Because most of the time when we're trying to manifest something, I mean, I think we can probably all agree on this. A lot of the time, I should say, when we're trying to manifest something, it's something external. So we want a new person in our life, or a new job, a new car, a new house, right? Something external to us. And there's a really important part that Neville's been talking about forever that we talk about over and over, and that's identity piece. So it's the internal work that gets done that gets me ready to have that thing, whatever
right.
it is.
Yes.
Because if my identity, my internal part of me, isn't ready for that thing, it sometimes does feel like it backfires.
Mm-hmm.
Either we get rid of it right away or it becomes a big problem for us
mm-hmm.
because we weren't ready for it in an internal way. So there's always sort of two parts to the work. Part of it is getting us ready to have that thing,
yeah.
not just bringing the thing into our life.
Yeah, I can think of an example that where that pops up quite frequently. You see it a lot on Facebook where I can't remember what the name of that other group is. There's another group that gets a lot of activity, and the name is Elephants, something about elephants, but a baby elephant group. The question that pops up there routinely is, I'm trying to attract my twin flame, or I'm trying to attract my soulmate, and they get a lot of advice about that. And then about a month later, you see, I attracted my soulmate, I attracted my twin flame, but all these things are going wrong. Why is everything going wrong? Which is exactly what you're talking about there, because they weren't really ready for it on the inside. And that it's so easy to overlook that piece. It seems like, of course I'm ready. I know I want this person in my life. How could I not be ready?
There's also a really interesting piece to the whole idea of a soulmate. And I think there are different definitions of what a soulmate is.
Mm, true.
I use a definition that it comes from sort of a Celtic idea of a soul friend, someone that's, you know, going to just fit perfectly with you. But there's another idea of soulmate too, and that's someone who is going to help you grow personally. And mm-hmm. that often doesn't feel very good. So, you know, be careful what you ask for, because sometimes that idea of the soulmate is the person that's going to cause you to grow more than anyone's ever caused you to grow.
Mm-hmm. This is true.
Cause you all this discomfort, right?
Growing is, you know, usually uncomfortable. Yeah, mm-hmm. a lot of growing pains in those relationships. So.
Yeah, there usually isn't much of a comfort zone when it comes to a new relationship. Usually everything is uncomfortable because you're getting to know each other and you're finding out, you know, where their person's strengths are and where your strengths are and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's a lot to take in. It can be overwhelming, actually, in the very early stages of a relationship.
So you think about that. The original question is, why do we sometimes manifest something and then it backfires?
Mm-hmm.
And in the scenario you're describing right now, that's a perfect example, too, even beyond the soulmate relationship, right? It's just that we think we're ready for something and then it shows up and we're overwhelmed by it and we weren't really maybe all the way ready, so... That's my answer. Maybe you guys have a different answer to that question.
That's good. Now she had a follow-up, so I thought I'd include the follow-up information. She says, like my patch-up with my family, I don't know what went wrong. Suddenly I get to hear so much. Wow, I never knew this was how they were feeling. I guess the atmosphere is very important, and the universe is trying to tell me to get the bleep out of here. Well, that's quite possible.
Maybe so. You know, I always think of the object lesson of baby birds in a nest, and that, you know, I mean, I can't recall anyway that I've been a bird in a past life, but I can imagine what it's like to be a baby bird and have to fly for the first time, right? It's like somebody parachuting for the first time. It's like not real comforting to have to dive out of the nest. Well, so the mother bird, when the babies are getting big enough to fly, she starts weaving thorns and things into the nest that won't be comfortable.
True. That's right.
So make the nest not so comfortable for them so that they'll fly, so that they'll get the bleep out of here.
No, I have to wonder if the bird could talk English, and the mama bird, I mean, and you talk to the mama bird afterward, would she be complaining that her kids never write home? I mean, is that kind of going to be one of those things, kick the kids out and then
probably.
Complain they're not coming back?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if she was Jewish. I can say that because I'm Jewish.
Yeah, you're the only one here. I can't possibly say that one. I'd get in so much trouble if I said something like that.
You know, the Jewish people sometimes think we have a monopoly on guilt, and Catholic people think they have a monopoly on guilt. And, you know, it's just not, there's plenty of guilt to go around.
Oh, on that note, okay. let's do some Neville.
Ready? All right. So the title of the sixth chapter is, I am he. For if ye believe not that I am, ye shall die in your sins. So I'll stop already, one sentence into the chapter,
right,
and just reiterate that when Neville talks about sin, he's going back to the original language where the word sin means that you've missed the mark, like shooting an arrow at a target and you missed the bullseye, or maybe you missed the target altogether, just missed it. You've missed it. And when he talks about forgiveness of sin, he's talking about correcting it. So when he says you have the power to forgive sin, he's saying you have the power to aim the arrow and shoot it straight now. You have the power to correct the things in your life that maybe you missed the mark about earlier. And so we look at this verse that he's quoting, for if you believe not that I am, ye shall die in your sins. He's basically, remember that I am statement, he's talking about us. He's talking about us having the power to create. So he's basically saying, if you don't believe that you have the power to create, then you're just going to die in this same space that you're in without ever correcting your path, without ever hitting the mark.
Yeah.
So,
you know, I did some extra research yesterday on this because this, these first couple of paragraphs really like shook me up because Nasha and I had a conversation about 2 weeks ago, I think it was, about, you know, does God create the bad things that happen in the world? And we were going around and around about that. So I had to look it up yesterday when I started this chapter, and it was saying that, like you said, sinning is missing the mark, and it's having a goal in life and not hitting it by not assuming the feeling of the wish fulfilled, because it's when we don't do that, we doubt God. And that is the sin that he was talking about in the, you know, research that I did. And he said, taking on the consciousness, assuming the feeling is the only way to reach our goal. So, yeah.
Particularly ironic pretty when important. You realize that God, as he uses that word, is also consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right. Which is us.
It is.
Right?
I am.
Yeah. Yeah.
All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. Again, the replacement, him, consciousness, all things were made by consciousness, and without consciousness was not anything made that was made. This is a hard saying for those trained in the various systems of Orthodox religion to accept, but there it stands. All things, good, bad, and indifferent, were made by God. God made man, manifestation, in his own image. In the likeness of God made he him. Apparently, adding to this confusion, it is stated, and God saw that his creation was good. What are you going to do about this seeming anomaly? How is man going to correlate all things as good when that which he's taught denies this fact? Either the understanding of God is erroneous, or else there's something radically wrong with man's teaching.
It's a great point. And that's what Didi was talking about. How do you reconcile the idea that that everything is good that was created by God, and yet some things seem to be bad? How can that be?
So let's see what Neville says. I have ideas, but I want to see what he says, because I have an idea, you know, that nothing's intrinsically good or bad.
I agree with you. I think that's where it's going to go, but let's find out.
To the pure, all things are pure. This is another puzzling statement. All the good people, the pure people, the holy people, are the greatest prohibitionists. Couple the foregoing statement with this one, there's no condemnation in Christ Jesus. There is therefore now no condemnation to them which are in Christ Jesus. And you get an impassable barrier to the self-appointed judges of the world. Such statements mean nothing to the self-righteous judges blindly changing and destroying shadows. They continue in the firm belief that they are improving the world. Man, not knowing that his world is his individual consciousness outpictured, vainly strives to conform to the opinion of others rather than to conform to the one and only opinion existent, namely, his own judgment of himself. When Jesus discovered his consciousness to be this wonderful law of self-government, he declared, "And now I sanctify myself that they also might be sanctified through the truth." He knew that consciousness was the only reality, that things objectified were nothing more than different states of consciousness. Jesus warned his followers to seek first the kingdom of heaven, that state of consciousness that would produce the thing desired, and all things would be added to them. He also stated, "I am the truth." He knew that man's consciousness was the truth, or cause of all that man saw his world to be. Jesus realized that the world was made in the likeness of man. He knew that man saw his world to be what it was because man was what he was. In short, man's conception of himself determines that which he sees the world to be. There's a really famous quote that often gets attributed to Anais Nin. It says, "We don't see the world as it is, we see the world as we are."
Mm-hmm.
Actually, from the Talmud. It's not Anais Nin's quote. It's a Talmudic quote. But it's what he's talking about right here, is that whatever's going on inside us, whatever our consciousness is, that's how we view everything. We always look through our own set of lenses.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of Abrahamic teaching, because Abraham also teaches that everything that's going on in the world is good. The world is not a broken world. Nothing needs to be fixed. It's all great
right.
The way it's working out. And that can rub people the wrong way, because a lot of people look around, they see all the stuff that they don't like that's going on. In fact, I saw a video today, again, in conjunction with a Facebook post, and I don't remember what the exact wording of the topic was that Abraham was addressing, but the gist of it was what we're talking about here. I think they called it the big missing piece or something like that. And that big missing piece is people focusing on stuff that's really not them. It's not their business. It's somebody else's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Abraham makes the point in the video that when like we're the person who's seeing this injustice going on over there, we think to ourselves, "Boy, am I glad I'm not over there, because even just from over here where I am, that just seems so unjust. It seems terrible what they're going through." But if you actually talk to the person who's going through it, they may have an entirely different perspective from that. They may not see it as this horrible thing that they're going through. It's the perspective that makes the difference.
Could very well be.
And when you look at it that way, all of a sudden you start to realize, oh my goodness, how often am I projecting my fears on a situation I'm seeing somewhere else?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had an experience like that with someone that I knew who had gotten into a new relationship, and one of their friends didn't think this relationship should be happening, mm-hmm. didn't think that this was the right person for her, didn't think, you know, and she was very happy, and the friend kept saying, I think you're all wrong for each other. This shouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the friend one day was sitting on a park bench, and her new partner was playing some kind of sport. So she was sitting there and she was watching him, and she said, "It was just the most wonderful day of my life. I was so happy. I was sitting there, I was watching him, he was having fun, the sun was shining, I was just loving it." And someone had taken a picture of her sitting there on the park bench. So she posted it somewhere on the web, and the friend said, "Oh, that picture was the saddest picture I've ever seen. You sitting there alone on the park bench, feeling so lonely and misunderstood, you know." And she was like, "Are you kidding? It was the best day ever. I was sitting there feeling so happy." And I thought of this verse that I was talking about we don't see the world the way it is. We see it the way we are. I'm like, that had nothing to do with reality, right? It was all a story that she was, but you know, I say that, but we all do the same thing.
Yeah.
We all have all these stories going on, right?
Oh my goodness.
It's amazing we ever get out of our own way. I mean, it really is, because we just find so many ways to set up these false scenarios that aren't actually going on.
True.
So true. So true. So many stories going on. So Neville says, "Creation is judged good and very good because it is the perfect likeness of that consciousness which produced it. To be conscious of being one thing and then see yourself expressing something other than that which you are conscious of being is a violation of the law of being. Therefore, it would not be good. The law of being is never broken. Man ever sees himself expressing that which he is conscious of being. You know, there's a little hint in that paragraph about what we talked about opening the show today with the question that Nasha had about manifesting something and then having it backfire, I think was the word
right,
that she used.
Right.
If you think about that, you know, what he's saying here, to be conscious of being one thing and then see yourself expressing something other than that which you are conscious of being is a violation of the law of being.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, therefore, it would not be good. Yeah, it is. When it's not feeling good because that happens, it's because whoever we think we're being is a little bit different than who we're actually being, right?
Another way we get in our own way.
The law of being is never broken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So be it good, bad, or indifferent, it's nevertheless a perfect likeness of his conception of himself. It's good and very good.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. If you imagine a painting of something, of some subject matter that's really awful.
From whose perspective?
But it's rendered perfectly.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's good and very good.
Yeah.
Right?
I think we're starting to zero in on what you and I were kind of leaning to earlier, and probably Dee Dee too, and that is it isn't so much good and bad, it's preferred and not preferred. It's what do we really want? You know, if I really want this thing, then for all intents and purposes, it's good regardless of what my neighbor thinks about it.
Well, and it's good in that it's a perfect reflection, whatever's happening. I mean, I can look around my environment and tell you exactly what's going on within me, because
mm-hmm.
it's just outpictured here.
Yeah, that's true.
And if it's something, right, and it's good and very good in the sense that it's an exact outpicturing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I may not think it's very good. I may look around and say, yeah, this is not very good. But it's good in the fact that it's a perfect outpicturing of whatever's going on in my consciousness.
One of my favorite phrases to use with somebody is good for you. And the reason I like that one is it doesn't have to be good from my perspective. All that it has to be is good from their perspective. And so I literally mean
that's what I literally mean.
Yeah, it's good for you, and I'm really glad that it's good for you. I'm sincere when I say that, because I know that they're enthusiastic about it. That's all I need to know.
I love that. I'm going to put that in my toolkit.
Well, thank you.
You know, I think the thing that Nasha and I were freaking out about this like creation is judged good and very good. We were talking about the bad things that go on in the world, you know, like murderers, child molesters,
mm-hmm.
sex trafficking, all that stuff.
And how God in the world, create that. People create that.
Exactly, exactly. But now that I'm reading this chapter, it's not that God judges it good, but it's the perfect manifestation of the person who's doing this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's what's in him, and he's manifesting it. So in that way, it's good.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, not that the thing is good. No. So
it's like, it's in focus.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Good way
to
describe
it. You know, you go through all the pictures that you took, and there's the good ones and the bad ones. The bad ones are all fuzzy and out of focus.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Right. So it's in focus.
There's also another thing that I find to be really empowering, and that's the reminder that the only time that, quote, bad, unquote, things happen to us is when we invite them in some form. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that we're looking to have bad things happen to us. I mean, we focus on stuff that doesn't really serve us, that doesn't feel good to us. And we persist in focusing on stuff that doesn't really serve us. And then all of a sudden we get a diagnosis of a disease. Like, well, where did that come from? Well, I mean, how much time have you been focusing on the stuff that didn't serve you? Oh yeah, I guess I was doing that. Well, knowing that to me is empowering, because now I know, okay, well, if I change my thought process, I can actually change my results. That to me is a very empowering thought.
It is. And I'm also going to jump in and say that we need to be really careful when we get into that area where we're saying nothing ever comes your way unless you invite it. And the reason why I say that is because we can get into the area of victim shaming when we get there.
True. Yes, that's true.
And that there have been catastrophes.
That's true.
You know, yeah. In other words, I live in a state where a whole city near me was flooded, almost every single house. So to say to an individual that just lost their home, well, you invited it.
Mm-hmm.
I could never do that because Do we attract vibrationally? Yes. We also live on a planet with 7.8 billion people, and all those people have a vibration too.
Mm-hmm.
And remember that if you put two grandfather clocks in a room and the pendulums are going in different directions, eventually they will sync up and swing the same way. Our vibrations entrain to each other. So think about the entire world of people having a vibration. That affects us, right? And then there are things that are completely out of our control. Like, people always bring up the Holocaust, of course, but other things like natural disasters and catastrophes. And, you know, so I'm really careful when I say things like that about, you know, the only way. And Neville would agree with you completely literally in that phrase, that the only way anything comes in is that you invited it. That's Neville to a T. I stand on the side of, it's a little more complicated than that in my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that we live on planet Earth where there is a lot of contrast in our life. And that's just the way it's going to be. And contrast actually can be something that helps us and forms us and develops us and informs us. So it's not bad, but it's usually not comfortable, right?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Wow,
that's
that reminds me. You guys remember when I think there was an earthquake in Turkey and all those people got killed, and there was a famous picture of a lady protecting her baby with her body, but she was not, you know, she was just protecting her baby from like the fallen rubble or whatever. You guys remember when that happened?
I don't remember that.
The Turkey.
I don't remember it either, but it sounds like
earthquake.
The kind of picture that would come out of something like that, so I can certainly, you know, imagine it.
Okay. Well, we had a friend that was from there, and I can't remember if she lived with us before that incident or after that happened. But I remember thinking, long after she had moved to her own apartment, reading an article about that incident, like, why did it happen? And it was saying it was because of the collective consciousness of the people in that country at that time. Is the reason why the earthquake happened. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness. But it just reminds me of what you were just saying, Cindy, that we really do have to be careful, you know, saying.
Life is complicated.
Mm-hmm.
This stuff can be complicated. It's not always so simple, you know, in my approximation. So, collective consciousness is a thing. And I think that many of the things that we experience that we feel are uncomfortable. I mean, look at politics right now. I think a lot it's a lot of collective consciousness and vibration.
Mm-hmm.
And it affects, you know, everyone pretty much. Now, it may affect us less if we're, if we're able to stay in a certain vibration, but you know, we are all learning.
Yes, we are.
We are all learning.
What I was referring earlier to being empowered, for me, the empowerment is, it's kind of, I guess it's actually the inverse of it. The realization that, well, if that's true, then I can also change my thought pattern. And when I change my thought pattern, I can improve my experience.
Absolutely.
That's like super powerful as far as I'm concerned. So.
Well, I heard somebody talking about this, and I wish I could remember exactly the way they said it, but it's a concept that I'm very familiar with. And agree with, and that is the concept of radical responsibility, which really means that I'm responsible for my experience.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different than blame. Blame is who made this happen.
Yes.
Responsibility is who's going to take care of it now.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
But more precisely, how am I going to respond? What response am I going to
bring
to it?
My ability to respond, right? My responsibility. Perfect. And so I think that's important for us to remember too, is we can say, why did this happen? Did it happen because of my consciousness? Did it happen because of collective consciousness? And when we're in that kind of questioning area, we're kind of treading that tightrope of the blame game a little bit, right? Whose fault is this? Who made this happen?
Absolutely.
Who do we blame for this? But if we can move over into a little more anabolic space of responsibility and say, how am I going to respond to this? Because I get to choose that. I didn't choose this thing to happen, but I do get to choose my response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned politics.
That's empowering.
It's very empowering.
Yes,
no
it
doubt.
Is.
And you mentioned politics. most often my recommendation for somebody is just keep your nose out of politics. Don't even go there. Don't watch the news. Don't do all that kind of thing. Now, having said that, I tend to be a little contrary, and I dip my toe into some of it occasionally anyway, which is probably not terribly healthy for me, but I still do it anyway. And part of the way I do it is I go in with the idea that the moment I start to feel something uncomfortable, I'm done with it. I'm going to go do something else. You know, but until then, I can kind of mess with it.
What's your record?
That's my record. Yes, that's right. It is.
What's your record? 15 seconds?
10 minutes? Well, actually, I spent a good portion of my lifetime on it, but I can't tell you exactly when it started to go downhill, so I can't give a good accurate measure of when that happened. Recently, I can probably go about 15 minutes before it starts to really affect me badly.
Pretty good.
Well, I've practiced. That's part of my point. My point is I have practiced in the contrast learning how to not let it affect me.
Yeah.
Learning how to just keep it, you know, my defense mechanism is humor. My favorite person to laugh at these days is Donald Trump. He is a funny guy.
Well, he's a good one to laugh at.
But you got to be in the right mindset for that. If you're not in the right mindset, don't go there. It's going to poison your mind. But if you're in the right mindset, he's hysterical. Just look at some of the Saturday Night Live cold opens. I mean, he's just nuts.
Oh, yes.
He's just absolutely nuts. So again, it's what your perspective is going to be. Your perspective is up to us, and that's really cool.
But you know what you said was so interesting about being aware of how something's affecting us.
Yes.
To where when we realize something's really uncomfortable, we can say, okay, and I don't mean bury our head in the sand. You know me, I mean, I'm an activist. I mean, I write about these things.
Oh,
I'm definitely not. I'm not wanting to say, oh, just ignore it and it'll go away.
No, that's not you at
all. What I am saying, though, is that being aware enough of our own response, our own internal response, to say, okay, I need to take a break from this for a while. This is not right. And then doing whatever you have to do to keep your vibration in a better spot. I mean, that I do a lot. Mm-hmm. I can do that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think we can. It's a learning curve sometimes to be able to keep that balance, but I think it's important that we do.
I think it's one of the reasons why we talk about contrast. It's Abraham word. Contrast is an Abraham word describing, you know, the plus and the minus, the good stuff and the bad stuff, all that kind of thing. And we don't always just dip our toes in. Sometimes we jump in up to our necks. Sometimes we wade into it. You know, but we do it for a reason. Every time that we do it for a reason, and we usually grow out of it. Almost always we grow out of it in one way or another. I think that's one of the reasons I keep dipping my toe into the political waters, just to see how much more of a boundary have I put up so that I don't allow it to affect me. I don't allow it to change my mood, change my emotions. Mm-hmm. It becomes a way to kind of practice that, kind of show myself, this is how much I've grown. This is how much I've actually become a powerful person.
It's been a wonderful practice opportunity. I mean,
sometimes more than people want.
All right, let's see where we're going here. I moved my screen a little bit to make sure I didn't lose my place, and it caused me to lose my place. Not only are all things made by God, all things are made of God. Okay, again, if we replace the word God with some of Neville's replacements, such as imagination or consciousness, that changes the whole tenor of the paragraph, right? Mm-hmm. Not only are things made by our imagination, but all things are made of our imagination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All are the offspring of God. God is one. Things or divisions are the projections of the one. God being one, he must command himself to be the seeming other, for there is no other. So this goes back to that whole everything is one thing kind of idea. The absolute cannot contain something within itself that is not itself. If it did, then it would not be absolute, the only one. Commands to be effective must be to oneself. I am that I am is the only effective command. I am the Lord, and beside me there is none else. You cannot command that which is not. As there is no other, you must command yourself to be that which you would appear. Let me clarify what I mean by effective command. You do not repeat like a parrot the statement, I am that I am. Such vain repetition would both be stupid and fruitless. It's not the words that make it effective. It's the consciousness of being the thing which makes it effective. Well, when you say, I am...
Let me interrupt before you go further there, because this ties into a question that Jeffrey asked a few minutes back, and it ties in directly to a comment you made about collective consciousness. He asked the question, what would we like to see in our collective consciousness?
Well, I think that answer is going to be different depending who you ask.
I think so too, but it's a good question. And it's a question that has a number of different possible facets to it, because people often think that the collective consciousness is going to mirror what they themselves think.
Right.
Yeah.
It's obviously not so.
Yeah, the evidence kind of points the other way, doesn't it?
Right?
Very true, yeah. I mean, he actually gave his examples. He says, I would like to see global abundance, global love, and global healing, which are very noble goals. I like those. I like those a lot.
Yes. Global peace.
Global peace?
Yeah.
I mean, that was the first word that came to my mind. Mm-hmm. That was the first vow I ever took as a very young child, was to bring peace to the world. That's sort of my thing. And so see how different the answers are, but we can all agree, right? Because peace, love, compassion, abundance, things we want, generally speaking, for ourselves, and we want for everyone.
It's a good practice, though, to try to identify what we want in terms of improvements that we'd like to see happen. Because we have this tendency as human beings to focus on, well, what I want is to no longer see what I don't want. That's the way most political issues are talked about. That's where most news is talked about. Almost everything that goes on in conversational stuff is about, well, I don't want this. I don't want that. I don't want that.
Yeah, and I was going to say, most of the time, if it's fear-based, that's how we tell.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
we
don't want that.
Exactly. Yep.
Right?
So it's a good exercise.
It is. It was a good question. Thank you.
Yep. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your reading, but I just had to make sure I got Jeffrey's question in there.
But I love this. It's not the words that make it effective. It's the consciousness of being the thing which makes it effective. When you say, I am, you are declaring yourself to be. The word that in that statement, I am that I am, indicates that which you would be. The second I am in the quotation is the cry of victory. This whole drama takes place inwardly, with or without the use of words. Be still and know that you are. This stillness is attained by observing the observer. Repeat quietly, but with feeling, I am, until you have lost all consciousness of the world and know yourself just as being. Awareness, the knowing that you are, is Almighty God. I am. I think that the interesting thing about this whole train of thought here from Neville is that there has to be generally some time spent in quiet and stillness to reach this state.
Yes.
And we live in a busy world with all kinds of information streaming at us from every direction, from the telephone and the television and the computer screen and everything just coming towards us, and we often don't take the time to get still and quiet and reach this state.
It's very true. Right. And there are a number of ways to do that, but it's a good practice to make sure we try to do it at least once a day, and preferably more often than that, so that we develop the habit of it.
Right. Practice, practice, practice. And, you know, I always kind of feel like, and I coach people around other things with this idea, right? Like practical things, habits people are trying to adopt, whatever they are, not necessarily meditation, but that small, consistent action is really powerful. And that's usually how we attain our goals. It's by small, consistent action, whether it's saving money or whether it's, you know, eating healthier or whatever. It's doing it consistently, not just a big blowout, you know, once. It's like, oh yeah, I meditated for 3 hours, you know, 2 months ago, and then I never meditated again.
2 months ago.
But even if you can just, you know, bring yourself into a space where you're really conscious of, I'm turning my cell phone off, I'm shutting the door, I'm going to take 5 minutes to just sit still and breathe and be aware of my own being. If you did that every day, pretty soon, because I've had this happen to me, it's really funny. I used to meditate every day at 5 o'clock. It was just on my calendar. And I noticed that after maybe 3 weeks of it, I start looking at my watch. Oh, is it 5 o'clock yet? Because it went from being something I had to, you know, make sure not to forget to something I was really desiring to do. And so I was excited about it.
That's a good
point. I was consistent, you know. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily for a long period of time every day, but it was definitely every day.
And having that kind of regular daily activity like that is, I think, no matter what the process is, whether it's meditation or almost any other process that we do, that's how we start to notice the change that's going on in us. Because until we have that regular practice, we don't really tend to kind of compare, where am I at with my general thought process today compared to, say, a week ago or a month ago or 6 months ago? Because now we have a reason to kind of track it to see, is this paying off? Is this working for me? And then I look back and I, you know, you mentioned earlier how I talked about how I would connect inside to see, well, I'm listening to this political stuff. How is it affecting me? And you were saying that's a good thing to do. That happens because I do daily processes. Until I did daily processes, I could never make that connection. That was not a possible connection for me, but now it is.
Well, what's interesting is that it's all about awareness.
Yeah.
And that's what Neville's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times it's easy to go through life unaware, just kind of numbed out to what's actually going on with us, because we get so busy we don't even take the time to process things. But when we start being consistent about some process, mindfulness and awareness, then, you know, like you said, over time, it really becomes a great tracking mechanism.
Yeah. And it's also kind of a reward mechanism built in, because now I feel like, oh, I really am making progress. Even if there are certain things that I've been requesting haven't shown up yet, I know the progress is there. I can now see it. I can feel it. I can experience it.
And that's exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So, Neville talked about assuming the feeling. I remember a long time ago reading that he was explaining how to know when you're not in the consciousness of that which you want to be. He likened it to wearing new clothes. Okay. Mm. When you put on new clothes and you go out into the world, you don't feel natural in them. You think everybody knows you're wearing new clothes, you know, and you feel sort of subconscious or whatever. And he says, but when you wear old clothes out into the street, they feel natural to you. So this new consciousness should feel natural. We have to practice it, make it a daily habit, you know, assume this feeling all the time until it becomes real, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was really interesting.
It is. That's a good example. It's a good example.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. So Neville says, when he talks about repeating quietly, I am, until you've lost the consciousness, it cracks me up. Every time I read that sentence, I lost consciousness. Wait, why does anybody lose consciousness? Until you've lost consciousness of the world and you just know yourself just as being, he says, after this is accomplished, define yourself as that which you desire to be by feeling yourself to be the thing desired, which is what you're talking about, Dee Dee. Mm-hmm. I am that. This understanding that you are the thing desired will cause a thrill to course through your entire being. When the conviction is established and you really believe that you are that which you desire to be, then the second I am is uttered as a cry of victory. This mystical revelation of Moses can be seen as three distinct steps. I am free, I really am. Makes me laugh. Because I think we've all had that experience of we often call it an aha moment, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, ever since we started reading this section of the book and all the I am statements that he's referring to, I've started incorporating it into my mirror exercises on some days, not all days, but I'll look into the mirror and I'll say, I am.
Oh.
I'll say, I am again. And I'll check my reaction. And if I don't see the reaction I'm looking for, I'll say it again until I get the reaction I'm looking for. It's an interesting thing to say to yourself, I am, while you're looking in the mirror. It's a weird thing.
But I like that.
It's good.
That's really good to add that into the mirror work. Because I've been doing mirror work every day.
Have you?
Very brief. Yeah. But, yeah. So, see, another thing I could add in there.
Yeah.
Let's see. It does not matter what the appearances round about you are like. All things make way for the coming of the Lord. I am the Lord coming in the appearance of that which I am conscious of being. Okay, so once again, he's bringing it all back to the individual.
Yep.
He's talking about the coming of the Lord. He's using that phrase as saying that's the moment that we recognize I am.
Yeah.
All the inhabitants of the earth cannot stay my coming or question my authority to be that which I am conscious that I am. All the inhabitants of the earth are as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the armies of heaven and among all the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand, nor say to him, what doest thou? The interesting thing here is that idea that there's nothing that can keep you from believing that you are that thing. I think we've all had to have had at least one experience in life where we were really convinced of something and just nothing was going to change our mind about it. And when it comes to ourself and our own individual I am statement and what we are committed to, that idea of like, no, this is who I am. No one can tell me that I'm not. I think that's what he's going for here.
Absolutely.
It's a conviction.
Yeah. Well, it's the same purpose for doing the I ams in the mirror work. To just remind myself, I really am, in Moses' words. I really am.
I really am. I am the light of the world, crystallizing into the form of my conception of myself. Consciousness is the eternal light, which crystallizes only through the medium of your conception of yourself. Change your conception of yourself, and you will automatically change the world in which you live. Do not try to change people. They are only messengers telling you who you are.
Oh.
Revalue yourself, and they will confirm the change.
They are only messengers telling you who you are. Oh, my goodness. Boy, doesn't that change?
I like that punch in the gut, but it's so right.
It changes every single perception we have about all these things we don't like about the what's out in the world. Oh, no, it's just a messenger about who you are. Oh, damn, it's me again. Oh, no.
That's right. I heard somebody say that one time. I'm trying to remember. They said they were asking this teacher about speaking in front of a group. And they said, but what about all the people that are there? And the teacher said, just you.
Just you.
Yeah,
okay.
Remember that. They're only messengers telling you who you are. Revalue yourself. I love that word. Revalue yourself.
Mm. Yeah.
And they will confirm the change. So, that idea that when we change our perspective, everything changes. When we change the way we look at things, the things we look at change. When we change our conception of ourselves, then we change the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now you will realize why Jesus sanctified himself instead of others. Why to the pure, all things are pure. Why in Christ Jesus, the awakened consciousness, there's no condemnation. Awake from the sleep of condemnation and prove the principle of life. Stop not only your judgment of others, but your condemnation of yourself.
Oh boy, triple underline there.
Yeah, I heard someone say one time, I think it was Gay Hendricks, say that one of the ways that you can tell if you're not loving yourself is by how often you judge other people. And he gave some examples of people saying, like, oh, look at her. She just bought a new car. She can't afford that new car. That's a bad decision. You know, those kind of judgments.
Yeah.
Where we think we know everything about other people's lives. And, you know, we make all these judgment calls about whether they made a right decision or not. You know, that kind of thing. He says when you find yourself doing that, it's one of the biggest signs that you don't love yourself. That you don't love yourself enough. That you could love yourself more. And I thought, ooh.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
By the way, Nasha has asked a question that kind of ties back to what we were talking about earlier, but I'm realizing it ties into this too. She says, what does LOA say about committing suicide? As Abraham Hicks says, we all leave our bodies when we want to. So does that make natural death and suicide the same thing?
I don't know what Neville says about suicide. I'm trying to remember what I've heard Abraham say. And I think it's that we all get to make our own choices.
Right.
Do you have any recollection of?
Oh, definitely. They're very clear about that. They say that every one of us, without exception, makes the decision about when we're leaving.
Not just the suicides.
Everyone.
But all of us.
Everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess
a thought that just came to me about the suicide thing is, if we look at life as a gift from God, committing suicide is like throwing that gift back in his face. Dang, this is crap. You know, I don't want it, so I'm out of here. I agree that we all, you know, have to make our own decisions about things. It's only we, you know, can live with whatever's going on with us. But I really do think it's like a slap in the face.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to bring in a different viewpoint here if he's interested, because Louis D'Souza, mm-hmm. who does the Monday morning podcast with me, has mm-hmm. logged onto the platform. And Louis, if you're interested, we'd welcome you coming on to share your opinion. Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hi, Cindy. How are you?
Hey, it's good to hear your voice. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Very well. I just popped on because I wanted to test my blue jeans, so sorry about that.
Well, that's all right. No, that's perfect. I
had no idea
anyway.
Somebody would be on. I just wanted awesome. To set it up. I just redone my PC.
Hey, if you've got
there are no
things
mistakes.
To do. See, this ties
no
in perfectly.
Mistakes. You're right. It came in at the right time.
This ties in perfectly with what we talked about before, about making assumptions about what's going on with somebody else's life. I made an assumption you were here to talk to us. Nope, that was the wrong assumption.
So Abram says that everybody commits suicide every time, okay? So every death is a suicide.
Every death is a
suicide. Interesting.
What that means is they keep on saying we create our own reality. Now, if you believe that completely, totally, and absolutely, and utterly, then, of course, all of us do commit suicide.
Hmm.
We create our own reality. We create our own death. So once I understood that, one thing that became very clear to me is not to get so caught up or worried or concerned about the people that did commit suicide as far as society looks as suicide. That became a lot easier. And then understanding that I'm really controlling how long I'm staying here and when I want to go as well, from some point of view, it was also very interesting. So there were a lot of things that changed once I started looking at that whole point of view of everybody commits suicide. It's really quite interesting.
It is interesting.
I found it extremely mm-hmm. beneficial.
Very good. Well, thank you for sharing that, and we'll let you go back to testing your equipment. But like you said, there are no mistakes. You came in at just the right time.
Yeah, I'll sit in the background and have a listen while I'm doing it, because obviously I have a whole lot of things. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing the rest. Take care and enjoy.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you next Monday, too. Take care.
Bye.
Well, so, I think that, you know, as far as people who actually choose suicide in a conscious way, because if every death is chosen, a suicide is usually consciously chosen, right? And I think that I probably don't look at it as a slap in God's face, but I probably have a different view of God. Mm-hmm. And my view of God is probably closer to Neville's, that God is not, I don't see God as something outside myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the main thing that concerns me with suicides is the people that are left behind. It's tragic, and that most of the time when someone takes their own life, if not all of the time, they're just in a lot of pain.
Yeah, they just want the pain to end.
Yeah, and so they're not seeing their life as a gift at that point.
Mm-hmm.
They're struggling, and they're in pain, and they're making a decision from that point, and they're just wanting to relieve the pain.
Yes.
And so that's hard in our, as a society. I think it's something that we need to learn more about. And, you know, just because it's hard on the people that experience their loved ones making that choice.
Mm-hmm.
But
very true.
We still get to make the choice.
Yeah.
Right.
Can I tell you guys a funny story?
Sure.
It's about Neville and Abdullah.
Okay.
We just read that he said, to the pure, all things are pure. Well,
right.
Neville was just fascinated that Abdullah was able to eat a bowl of ice cream and drink a glass of rye every single night. He was like, well, how can you do that?
What a combination.
How can you do that and not kill you? Well, Abdullah was like, well, it would kill you. You can't do it because you don't believe. You don't believe that these things are pure. I do. You know, you think there's something wrong with eating meat. You think there's something wrong with this and that, you know. So, therefore, it would kill you. You know,
Abdullah sounds like Abraham.
He does, in that sense, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
It's like the worst thing you can ever do is something that you think is bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's good. That's funny.
What was that, Louis?
I love that story, Deirdre. Love it. I love it because it reminds me of Ramdas's story where he goes to this field. He's a Harvard professor, and he went to India to sit at the feet of a guru. And this guru kept on saying to him, you must try these drugs. You must try these drugs. And eventually the guru got to a stage where he said, we'll bring this to a head. And he said, okay, bring me your drugs. He said, okay, how much? He said, bring me all your drugs. So Ramdas went and he got his whole stash of drugs and brought them back. And the guru sat in front of him and took all the drugs and continued chatting to Ramdas and as though nothing happened, and nothing did happen to him. And it's a great example of exactly the same thing. For Ramdas, he would have tripped out all over the place, but when somebody believes that he has totally control,
as the main host of the podcast, I want to make sure that I tell our audience we are not recommending that you do the same thing that guru did. We are not recommending that at all.
We are not recommending that you do all the drugs.
No, do not do this. You're not ascended as high as
Ramdas. Ramdas studied psychology, and he said, who I was when I was a Harvard professor would have put who I am now into a straitjacket.
Yes.
Because he had changed so much, and he was in such a different wavelength.
I love one thing that he says. He says we're all just walking each other home.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
I like that.
Wow.
Very good.
Yes.
Well, the only sad part is we've run out of time, because this is great. I'm loving this. But unfortunately, we're going to have to finish chapter 6 next week. But Cindy, let's mark it, make sure we know exactly where we are, because I mean, we always get lost. Okay, so we got it down this time. This is great. Dee Dee, thanks for jumping in also. We love the commentary you brought to the table here.
Thank you, guys. I love you. It's so much fun.
Thanks to our friend Louis, also for jumping in. Louis, we appreciate your insight.
Just,
and to our listeners.
Thanks for having me ad lib here.
Absolutely. Loved it. And thanks to our
nice to
listeners.
Touch base with other hosts. Cause...
It's great. That's what makes this thing so cool. I love it. I never would have thought of this, you know, 6 years ago, 6.5 years ago when I started this. I never would have thought it would turn into this, but this is great. I am loving this.
Yes.
So with all that in mind, we're going to say thank you for listening. We'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.